going to begin a series of shirim, a series of lessons, discussions on names. And the reason we're doing that is we are in Bereshit, in the book of Genesis, chapter 29, and we're about ready to begin that part of the Torah where Yaakov and his wives are blessed with children, and they name their children. If you take a look at page 172, sentence 31, page 172, sentence 31. Vayar Adonai ki snua Leah, and the Lord saw that Leah was hated. Vayiftach et rachma, and the Lord opened her womb. Virachil akara, but Rachel was barren. Now, Rachel is the third woman, the third matriarch, who is actually mentioned in the Torah as being akara. Sarah is described as being akara at the end of chapter 11. Rebecca is described in chapter 25 as being akara. And here Rachel is described as being akara. Yes, Galit.
Would that equate Rachel with the other two as Leah being different?
Like, I feel that's like a great point.
Could it possibly be that the Torah is saying, other than Leah also being hated, Rachel was also the better wife, therefore she was equated with the other two, therefore she was the one who's going to cause Yaakov to
Well, I would say this, that each of the Imahot were distinct personalities, but they were similar in that they are, three of them are described as Akarot. In that way, they were similar. But there were many, many differences between Sarah and Rivka and Rachel. Many, many differences. Now, I just following up on what you're saying, it would seem that the one who was different as it relates to being barren was none other than Leah. Well, it does say that Sarah is barren. The only one of the four matriarchs who immediately has a child
is Leah.
But when you read through this text, Jess, it seems almost as if the Torah is offering an excuse why she has a child right away. Look what it says. And the Lord saw that she was hated. Oh, she's hated. In other words, had she not been hated, maybe she too would be bad. Maybe it's good to be hated, you know?
So maybe like the fact that she was hated. So the fact that he loved Rachel, it would give him an incentive to pray for her. But had Leah been barren, he would not have any incentive to pray for her since she was hated.
Okay. Good. It's a good point. I'm simply pointing this out. Now, there's another famous Akara. Who is that? None other than Chana. None other than Chana. And what's the difference between them? How is Chana different than all the others? Galit.
I feel like she prays for herself as opposed to having her husband pray.
I thought
for
that's
her.
My Torah. I think we should switch seats, Galit. Great. Spell that out. That's wonderful. Say that out again.
She prayed for herself.
The tuition money is going for good reason.
She took initiative when she realized that she had no children.
Right.
She was the one who went to Eli to pray. But when Sarah didn't have any children, she was not the one to pray. It was Abraham.
Galit's saying something very, very significant, that if we take a look, chapter 16, page 75, and then page 76. That's the chapter where Sarah suggests, page 75, suggests to Avram that he marry Hagar. And Hagar immediately becomes pregnant, and Sarah becomes very, very angry. Why does she become angry? So according to the Midrash, she becomes angry because she says, because when Abraham was praying for a child, he prayed that he have the child. He was less concerned as to who would mother the child. And then in the story of Yitzhak, it says that Yitzhak prays for Rebekah. Rebekah's not praying for herself. And even with Rachel, Rachel turns to Jacob and says in the beginning of chapter 30, says, pray for me. Now what makes Chana different, and the reason why Chana, is the paradigm of prayer in the Gemara, the fifth parak of Brachot, is that Chana is the first one to assume responsibility. There's nothing wrong with praying for someone else. But Chana is the person who moves her lips, even voice, though voices don't come out. She's praying on behalf of herself.
I'm and puzzled.
Is there any mention of Chana's name?
Yes, sure there is. Yeah, we have the name, Elkanah. Elkanah. Nothing to write home about. Let me tell you. Maybe. Even though his name is Kelkanah, I've acquired the Lord. I'm connected with the Lord. Yes.
On what basis is Leah referred to as barren? She had the child very soon after their marriage.
So is that Rachel?
Leah.
So no, she's not referred to as barren. Too. She's the only one who's not referred to as barren. Because she has the child right
away. Yeah, but because she was hated is why she had the child. So it insinuates that she was barren.
Right. That otherwise maybe she would have been barren. It kind of says that, well, let's take this further.
Right.
Now let's see what's happening here. In the next sentence, Vatar Leah Vatelet Ben. Leah becomes pregnant. She gives birth to a child. What's the relationship between Vatahar, Tahar, and being pregnant? Probably comes from the word Har. Probably. Hara. Har too is a mountain. You show. Right. Vatar Leah Vatelet Ben. She gives birth to a son. Vatikrashmo Reuven. She calls his name Reuven. Ki amra, because she said, ki ra'a donai banyi, the Lord has seen my affliction. Ki ata, because now, ata with an ayin, ye ehavani ishi, my husband will love me. Now, just looking at that, what's your reaction to all of this? What's your reaction to her going about? Now, we're going to have many, many sentences talking about the way they're naming children, and by the time we're through, probably spend two, maybe three sessions on this. We're going to go through everybody's name. And we're going to try to understand everyone's name to the best of our ability. And I'm going to be leaning on you to help me with the Yiddish name where I'm less than a novice. Yes?
Well, to start with, it's the woman that named the child. It's not the father.
Excellent. Super. It's a super point. Ruby points out, wait a minute, who's naming the child? As a matter of fact, every single one of the 12 tribes is named by the mother, except for Levi. And there are commentaries, pages long, we're going to go through some of them, trying to explain why in the case of Levi, the third child, it seems that it's Yaakov who names the child. But as it relates to the naming really comes to the mother. I always tell the chevra when they have children, that the father can decide who will be the tzaddik. The mother has the priority when it comes to names. At least when you look at the Torah, look, it should be a peaceful decision made between all of them. But the Torah talks about how the mother is naming, mother names the child. Even with Binyamin, we'll talk about that. Binyamin, Benoni, Binyamin, we'll talk about that. That's chapter 35. What else do you see within this sentence? Anything else? Yes?
If the name is Reuven, then why doesn't she describe it with words that would hint to Reuven? So it seems to me that Rashem Boni, so she should call him Reuoni or something. Reuven does not seem to go with her translation of why she chose the name.
Right. Now, let's think about that, because, again, Galit has a great question. What should... Your question is that when you look at the name Reuven, and you see her reasoning for the name, Ra'a Hashem Be'anyi, the Lord saw in my affliction.
Right.
What are you saying, Galit? That there's no
the way that she describes it, the way that she describes the reason, like, let's say I wanted to name somebody.
Yes.
I love lilacs or something. So I said, I love lilacs, and then I named my child a cucumber or something.
Right. But let's see if we can figure this out. Let's look at the name Reuven. Reuven, the Reu is, it's an acronym. It's like Sunoco, the Sun Oil Company. That's an old one. It's an acronym. So Reuven, the Reu is Ra'ah. The Vav and the Yud are interchangeable. It's Ra'ah Hashem. Now the Ven is probably Be'anyi. See the Bet Nun? It's the Bet and the Nun of Be'anyi. That's probably what it's about. Although your question is probably better than my answer, but that's probably what it's all about. Yes, Chicago Bulls, you are?
Well, I learned some...
What's your first name?
Gamliel,
what a name.
I learned some classes here. We learned Shmuel, and when she names Shmuel, she says, Kisha Mal Hashem. I forgot, but his name should have been Shaul. But Chana names in that because we learned that, like, sometimes the meaning doesn't match the word, but as long as it, like, works, like, as long as it sounds the same, they do it.
Well, we're going to talk about that. That's a great, great point. Now, that's a great, great point. So what we're saying is that there's an association between the name and what's being described here. Ki ra'ah Hashem be'anyi. Now, my point of departure in talking about names is I'd like to first talk about the importance of names and even the importance of names as it relates to God Himself. As a matter of fact, the first name in the Torah is who? Who?
Adam.
Right, that's true. You're absolutely right.
Hashem, does he name us?
But Bereshit bara, in the beginning, Elohim, in the beginning, God created. So the first name that is found in the Torah is not a human being. The first name that is found in the Torah is God's name. God has a name. His name is Elohim. As a matter of fact, in sentence 4 of chapter 2, there, this creates all kinds of discussion. The first sentence of the Torah says, in the beginning God created, Bereshit bara Elohim. In sentence 4 of chapter 2, page 8, it's Ele Toldot Hashamayim v'ha'aretz v'hi baram. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. Biyom Asot, on the day that he created, who Adonai Elohim Eretz v'shamayim. So in chapter 2, God is no longer called Elohim. What is he called? Hashem Elohim. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, believe me, throughout chapter 1, Howie, without exception, God is called Elohim. Bayas Elohim, Bayom Elohim. In chapter 2 and in chapter 3, there God is called Hashem Elohim. And in chapter 4, the story of Cain and Abel, God is called Hashem. And in chapter 17 of Genesis, God is called Kael Shakai. What is Shakai? Shakai, Shaddai, Shin Dalad Yud. It's another name of God. There are many appellative titles to God. As a matter of fact, God has so many names. You know what the biblical critics say? They say, no problem, chapter 1 was written by one author. Chapter 2 and 3 was written by another author. So then there is the God of E, there's the God of J. There's a whole Torah on that. But let's realize that when we're talking about names, that names, of course, involve us, but names also apply to God Himself. And that's where I want to begin with. I want to begin with trying to talk about names of God, because my sense is, let me tell you where we're going. Once we have a handle on understanding why God receives names and and gaining an understanding of what the names of God are all about, maybe this will shed light, some light, on human names. Yes, Estelle?
This question, I'm sure, has probably been asked a million times, but if it's one God, why is it a plural name?
Yeah. That's a great question. That question is asked on Bereshit Aleph especially.
I'm sure.
Why it is Elohim? why, in fact, with the creation of the human being, is it Naseh Adam? Let us, who was God talking to?
Well, don't you, like, when you're ever talking to yourself, do you ever say, okay, come on, let's do this, go eat.
Right.
Which was, we're not speaking about ourselves, we're speaking about God. It's
we're going to come
God.
To that. Right. So we're gonna come to that. We're going to deal with that. Don't let me go on that. We've got to understand what... Let's take a look at chapter 3, because in chapter 3, Moshe has this encounter with God at the burning bush. The burning bush is the Sneh. And that was Moshe's first encounter with God himself, David. Right? You know what David means. Beloved. Dodi. And neither Dodi, but Dodi Li. So God appears to Moshe at the Sneh. He says to Moshe, listen here, Moshe. I want you going to Egypt, and I want you telling Paro, Shalach et ami, let my people go. I was thinking, by the way, I think we've got to go back to the Russian place, because the Russians are the key supporters of supporting the Iranian nuclear program. That's not good. Jess, got to get the signs out again. You know, get the dirt off the spikes. We're ready.
I've heard you say, let my people go before.
Yeah, and it's in the Torah. Guess what? Before me. Shalach et ami, let my people go. So let me tell you this scene. It's a wild scene. Turn to page 329. 329. In fact, let's turn to page 331. Page 331, sentence 13. Now God appears through the Sneh, and he tells Moshe, go tell Paro Shalach et ami. Vayome Moshe El Ha Elohim. That's, by the way, another name of God. It's not Elohim, it's Ha. Ha. The Ha, for example, in the Akedah, in the binding of Isaac, it's not Elohim, it's Ha. What's the difference, Howie? Not bad. What's the difference? I bet your Rebbe never discussed that. What's the difference between... Now between Elohim and Elohim. Vayome Moshe El Elohim. Hinei Onochi Ba El Bnei Yisrael. Behold, I am coming to the children of Israel, Moshe says to God. Vamarti Lahim, and I will say to them, Elohe Avotechem Shlachani Alechem, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Because not only does Moshe have to convince Paro to let the Jews go, he's got an even bigger task. What's his bigger task? To convince the Jews to leave. There's a Midrash that says that in the end, 4/5 of the Jews remain. You know, leadership by definition means change. Leadership means change. It's assume responsibility to change. The second step is people resist change. And even when you're slaves, people resist change. People are very comfortable in their settings. That's the way it is. So Moshe says, I'm going to come to the Jewish people. Before I even get to Paro, I got to tell the people. The people got to be with me. I can tell Paro, you know, from today till tomorrow, hype is Morgan, that let him go. But if the Jews don't want to go, nope. So I'm going to come to the Jewish people and I'm going to try to convince them. I'm going to try to convince them that it's time to get out. But Amru Li, here it is, Mashmo. They're going to say to me, what is his name? What is God's name? Azakasha. This is the question. Ma Omar Aleihem. What should I tell them? It's fascinating. Look at the next sentence. Vayom Elohim Moshe. God says to Moshe, you know what you should tell them? Eyeh Asher Eyeh. Translation here. I am that I am. It's like the old mad comic books, remember? Hosea Mandius, whatever his name was. I am what I am. Tell him, I am. Get it from here. I am that I am. Vayomer, God says. He repeats. Because, you know, whenever you have two Vayomers and there's nothing in between, God is speaking to Moshe. God says to Moshe, tell them my name is Eyeh Asher Eyeh. So then there's another Vayomer. Who does the next Vayomer refer to? Moshe again. So whenever you have two consecutive Vayomers, and it refers to the same speaker, you wonder about it, because you would imagine that in between these Vayomers, there should be a response from Moshe. I have a general rule. When there are two Vayomers, two verbs, Vayomer, referring to the same person, Vayomer Moshe, and then again it's Vayomer referring, excuse me, Vayomer Elohim, and then another Vayomer referring to Elohim, it probably means that there was a little bit of space between.
Didn't Chama Levi say that when you have one Vayomer and then same speaker, then you have another Vayomer, that something happened between there.
Right. Now, what I think happens, this is just conjecture, I'm not sure, is that God says to Moshe, Moshe says to God, I'm going to come to the Jews, they're going to ask me what your name is. What should I tell them? Moshe says, you know what you tell them? Tell them my name is I Am That I Am. I could just see it. You know, Cecil D. DeMille, whatever his name is. Moshe's chin drops. You want me to tell them your name is I Am That I Am? What is this? What is this all about? What are you talking about? It's going to make no sense. Vayomer, God repeats, Kol Tom Aleph Nei Yisrael. This is what you should tell them. Eyeh Shlochani Aleichem. Eyeh. I am has sent me to you. What is this all about? You know, if I didn't know better, I'd think this is Purim Torah. That Moshe says to God, I got to convince the Jews. They're going to ask me, what is your name? God says, you know what, tell them, you know what my name is? What is my name? Robert is my name. Avraham is, what is my name? My name is I Am That I Am. I'm trying to get a handle on the deeper meaning of Moshe's question. What is the deeper meaning of this question? And what's the deeper meaning of God's response? What is the deeper meaning of, is this what's going to bother the Jews? That the Jews want to know what God's name is? What is that?
Is the inference a name doesn't matter?
Okay.
All the Egyptian gods had names.
I was about to say. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. That's another way of looking at it.
Louder.
They had names.
Say a little louder.
And therefore, they had names, Ruby, and therefore, what is God's name? Yes? Any other thought?
What the substance is, really. What the who or the what of God is.
Ah!
It doesn't matter if it's the first name or just the first name. Convince me on whose account are you coming.
So what is, when Moshe says, they're going to ask me, what is your name?
Like, what is your...
What is that? What is that question about? What I think is being said, and I think this, if somebody asks me, and obviously this is the first text we're going to, I think when we discuss names, this is, I believe, where you begin. Where you begin is, a name is not just a name.
The identity, the revelation.
When Moshe says to God, they're going to ask me, the Jews, what is your name? Basically, what he's saying is, God, I'm going to come and I'm going to say, you know, God has told me that you're leaving Egypt, and they're going to say to me, what is this God? Who is this God? Where is this God? That's what Va'amru li mashmo. A name is not just a name. A name defines, if you will, on many, many different levels, who you are. And in this case, as it relates to God, Moshe is looking for the definition of God, for an understanding of God. Yes.
I have when I learned and I studied in the Montreal Jewish Teachers Seminary, I had a very exceptional teacher whose name was Yechiel Stern, and he told a story that when you die, you come up to heaven, and the Rebbeinu Shloim will ask you, who are you? What's your name?
That's something.
And the way in which you present yourself there will tell everything about you.
Right.
And so we started to analyze that, and it was, how do I say it? Do I say, I'll give an example for myself, Gela Schweigfischman? Do I say Gela Bas Avram? All of these possibilities went around the classroom about how are you going to present yourself to God. And I will never ever forget it, because
it's a very powerful
story. Never mind, I'm introducing myself to you, which is also very important.
I'll tell you what's going through my mind, Gela. It's one thing when you name a child in the beginning of life. It's another thing when at 120 years you come before God and God says, now tell me your name.
Yeah.
It's a whole different world. I sometimes ask myself, if I had a chance to name our children again, what name would I give them? Would it be the same name?
would it be the same name? I once said that to my kids. But they gave it right back to me. He says, well, yeah, well, what name will we give you? Schlamazel. You know, what's the name? Dubnik. You know, what should it be? But the point, though, is, Chevra, a name is not just a name. Names are everything. In the Torah, when you read Torah, names are so powerful. Extremely, extremely, you know, you read the beginning of Ruth, shame, ba ba ba, shame, shame, constant, as a matter of fact, it's not a coincidence, and I think this is true for all of humankind, but we, the Jewish people, Abraham is a descendant of which son of Noah? Shame. Not Ham, not Yefet. Now, of course, by no way am I implying, of course, all people have names, and names are of great significance, and we must, you know, show respect to the beauty of all names, whoever is carrying that name. But my point very simply is that when Moshe says, he's about ready to go, God says, tell the Jews, we're going. That God said, you're going. So Moshe says, tell me your name. And he's not just asking, you know, your name is Chaim Yoizel. He's saying, God, tell me something about you. It's the Yechiel story. Tell me your name. How do you define yourself? How are they to understand you? Now, when I read this, I begin to wonder, does that mean that our names, we are created in the image of God, somehow are supposed to define who we are? Or, when our parents gave us our names, does it, on some level, describe what their hopes are for us? What is that name about? But it's not a superficial kind of process, or it's not a superficiality that we're carrying these names, because names really are supposed to, in our lore, in Torah, supposed to really offer a definition of who we are. Charles?
Never having studied this before, the image I always had about I am that I am, that God gave a name that was recognizable as a name, create an anthropomorphic image of that name, and people would not have the
terrific
that the nothing name would be able to associate with him, and therefore not have the same kind of awe and respect.
That's great. It's a great, great, great point, Charles. Yes. I'm not noticing that at all. I only noticed that in myself. I'm sorry. Okay, and when you do?
Gela, you have to know in my classroom every, like, 5 seconds, somebody's like, oh, I forgot what I was going to say. Never mind, next.
That's so sweet. Thank you. We want you here every Tuesday, Khalid. Forget chemistry.
Can you give her a note?
I'll give you a note. Oh, there we go.
The fact is that God is indescribable. When you can't limit him to a name, what he's saying is that you can't compress me into a name. That I'm all over, I'm everything, I am what I am. That is very powerful. Nobody else can say that.
Right. Now, these are great segues. What Gail is saying, what Charles is saying, great segue to the response. But let me give you the mainstream understanding of what I am, that I am means. Eyeh asher eyeh. Proper translation is either I am, that I am, or I am because I am. So Maimonides, Rambam, who is the arch rationalist, he would say that what this means is that God calls out, you tell the people, you want to define me? I am because I am. Every human being would have to say, I am because somebody else was. We all have parents who have parents who have parents all the way back. We're not self-existent in the sense that we're dependent upon a mother and father who together helped create us. What's happening here, according to Maimonides, is that God is offering a philosophical definition of who he is. And the philosophical definition that he gives to Moshe is, you go tell the people, I am self-existent. I am independent of any entity. Human beings need others to exist. God needs no other. God minus the world equals God. World minus God equals nothing. But God minus world equals God. So Rambam says, this is a proof of God's existence. You want to know who I am? You want to know my definition? Says Rambam, the definition is Eyasheyeh, I am because I am. It's what's called in more modern terminology the cosmological argument for the existence of God, which is based on the law of conservation. The law of conservation says that matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed. They may be in different forms today, but it can't be created nor destroyed, which means that the same amount of matter and energy that exist in the world always existed. Now, this is a very important law of science. Well, if the same matter and energy always existed, then who created the first matter and energy? That's the issue. We all come from something, and that something comes from something. But where did the first something come from? We all come from something. So, the cosmological argument would argue that the first something from nothing, Bereshit bara Elokim, bara is a verb. It's called in the Latin creatio ex nihilo, yesh me'ayim. From nothing, God created that which was necessary for shamayim ba'aretz, the heavens and the earth. But the bottom line is, without boring you, Moshe asks God, what is your name? Give me your definition. How are you to be defined? And according to Maimonides, Maimonides says, you want my definition, you want an understanding of who I am, which according to Maimonides means that God says, you want a proof that I am? The proof is, I am because I am. Nobody else can say that. Only God can say that. So says Maimonides, and I'd like to offer an alternative suggestion after Estelle makes her comment.
I just want to say, isn't Jehovah a Yehovah, or Yahweh? Isn't that the main meaning of it? I was, I am, I will be?
Excellent. And that is a great segue, Estelle, to what I want to say. And that is that Eyeh Asher Eyeh. Jesse, help me. What does Eyeh mean? What is
I will be.
I will
be. That's what I kept wanting to hear.
That's it. And I am not aware. I'm not aware of any English translation that doesn't. I'm only aware of English translations that define, that translate Eyeh Asher Eyeh to mean I am that I am, or I am because I am. That's not what it means. Eyeh Asher Eyeh means I will be that which I will be. That's what it means. It's a very different than I am that I am. Now I want to go back to something that Geller said. In a certain sense, a name is very limitative. Why is that? Because a name means, from a certain perspective, if I have a name, it means I can be classified. I can be understood. I can be labeled in a particular fashion. And I think what's happening here is that God says, that Moshe says to God, what is your name? And you know what God says? I have no name. I have no name. Because once you give me a name, it means you've limited me, and God is limitless. I have no name. You can't put me in your back pocket, God says to Moshe. You can't confine me. You can't define me. You can't do that. So now I'm reading into the text. After God says to Moshe, I have no name, Moshe says, thanks, but what am I going to tell the Jews? So open your hearts now, because this is the thrust of what I want to say this morning. Are you ready? God then says to Moshe, I have no name, but if you're pushing me, I'm going to tell you how you can... he says, I have no name, but if you're pushing me, you know, they're fixing the steps, because we're... You're pushing me, he says to Moshe, and you should know I have no name, because
a God that can be named is a God who is limited, who is finite, and God is unlimited and infinite. We have names because we're limited. We're here one day, we're gone the next. God is limitless. So Moshe says, but you got to help me, God. What am I going to tell them? What am I going to tell them about you? What is your definition? What is your name? What is your name on the God level? So God says to Moshe, this is the key. You tell the people, and this is the Midrash. They want to understand me? Tell them, Eheyeh. Tell them, I will be with them. Asher Eheyeh. Not only will I be with them now, I will be with them in the future. That's what you should go and tell the people. Go and tell the people that I am not the God that you can define, as I've pointed out, that you can limit. I am not the God that you can intellectualize about. With all due respect to the arch-rationalist, to Maimonides, who understood I am that I am to be a rational intellectual argument. God says, I am because I am. Everybody has to say I am because somebody else is. Then there's going to be somebody else who's going to come on the scene and puncture that kind of intellectual argument. Is there any way to really intellectually prove God's existence? Rabbeinu Tam once said, the grandson of Rashi, that the best way to prove God's existence, the best way to know that your proof of God is incorrect, is once you put forth the proof. Because a proof of God is a limitation of God. That which you can prove is on some level of limitation. And God cannot be limited. The best way, the best proof of God's existence perhaps is, maybe some would look at this as a rationalization, that you can't prove God's existence. So God says to Moshe, God says to Moshe, I'm not the God of the head. I'm not the God that you can intellectualize. Rather, who am I? God says, I am the God of the human experience. I am the God, not that you can intellectualize, but I am the God that you can experience. I am the God that you can encounter. I am the God of the dialogue, of the give and take. You know who I am? God says, Eheyeh. You tell them I will be with them. They're in Egypt. And it's a tough time in Egypt. The Hebrew of Egypt is Mitzrayim. And the word Mitzrayim comes from the word Tzarat, Tzar, Kol Olam Kulo Geshet Tzar Ma'od. The whole world is a world that's narrow, that's in distress. All seems lost. And yet from the narrow instrument could come the most beautiful sounds. Right, Aryeh? From the most ideally. That's the concept. That's what God says. Says the Midrash, Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh. God says to Moshe, you tell the people, Eheyeh Imam Bitzara Zot. I am going to be with them through this distress, through Egypt. I'm going to be with them in Egypt. Asher Eheyeh Imam Bitzara Acheret. Just as I am going to be with them in future Egypts. I am not the God of dogma. I am not the God of intellect. I am the God that I can be experienced. And from the depth of experiencing me, you will come to know me. Now, there's a nuanced difference, but it's a world of difference. What this is suggesting is that for Maimonides, how do we come to know God? By intellectualizing God. For this other view, which is the view of Rashi and Rav Yehuda HaLevi, do you know how we come to, I'm embellishing on it, but it's their view, how do we come to know God? Not by intellectualizing God. Can we intellectualize God? You know how you come to know me? By experiencing, and from the depth of that experience, from the encounter, you'll come to know me. It's like a love relationship. How do you know you're in love? How do you know you're in love? You know. Let me tell you something. If you've got to sit down with pen and paper, if you've got to figure out how you're in love, you're in a lot of trouble. Love is an encounter. It's an experience. How do you know you're in love? How do you know you're in love? You know you're in love. You just know you're in love. That's what's happening here.
And if you have to ask, you're not.
By the way, I want to come back to what you said, Estelle. You said that Ayashaya, you said, isn't this, what did you say, isn't it close to Yud Kei Vav Kei?
Hayahovevi, that's the point. What does Hayahovevi mean? Haya means was, Hove is, and it's the same concept. I am the God that was in the experience with me. I am the God that is in that experience. I am the God that will be in the experience. Noga, your comment.
Well, I just wanted to say that just to give people love, to give people a dream, we're talking about what the, how that once Moses to come and convince the people may be enough for some people. But there are many people who need a history, who need, and that's why the second line, God comes back and says, I'm the same one who was that day. It's not beautiful. Enough just to sell the future. You have to have the past.
Right.
You have to prove the past.
Right. So you need the past of that experience, of that impact. But part of it also is, I guess somewhere you had to start where there was no past, where there was just the faith and the trust. But here there is a past. And you're saying once there is that past, then you're on Yeshra Glayim Ladava, that there's also, as there was something in the past, there's going to be something in the future as well.
You have to agree to the experience that it actually constitutes what that means, love.
And by the way, sometimes you can't define it, because if you can define it, you're limiting it. Sometimes it's beyond that. You know, it's interesting. It
could be very different than what you started out looking for.
It could be very different. Absolutely. If something just hit me, I don't want to forget it. So I want to just say that I don't want you to forget it. You know what? I'd rather hear what you have to say. Then I'll come back to it. I want to formulate it a little bit more. Yes, please. Yes, perpetual. Constant.
Yes, but usually when you're talking about love, there's an object that you love. You can't just love something
Absolutely.
That isn't there.
Absolutely.
Yes, you can.
No, you can't. Well,
you can love an idea. No, you can't love in a vacuum. The point is, you can love an idea. You can love a dream. That you can love. That's still. But Estelle saying you can't love in a vacuum. Some argue the mystics in Hasidic circles, God creates the world. Not that God needs the world. God is self-existent and independent. But for God to function in this world, for God to be manifest in this world, then God loves, and by definition, love means there has to be an entity to love. Some argue the reason why God creates the human being is because God is a God of love. The God of love creates. Yes, Jesse.
Well, I wanted to stick in the defense of the Rambam, the archetype of rationalism or intellectualism. In that, in many ways, we felt, and it's not for everyone, that this is our highest level of experience.
Yes, it is.
The highest level of experience is our intellectual experience. The highest level of our soul and our self-fulfillment for the great intellect and physician and scholar was that the highest a human can aspire to is that intellectual.
Absolutely.
So for those who hope to perhaps experience on a higher level than their intellectual experience, I'm not sure who presented a higher level.
Right.
That being the highest level of the soul.
Right. As you're speaking, Jess, what strikes me is you've described it so beautifully. It's almost like that highest intellectual experience becomes an experiential moment. One of the most brilliant intellects I've ever had the honor to sit before was Rabbi Soloveitchik. When you sat before him, it was almost like, and I was really too young to appreciate it. As I got older, after I received ordination, I appreciated him every day more and more. And I think I would appreciate him now much more. But it was almost like a maestro leading a symphony, and you could see the beauty of the of the experience of being in nature itself. It was almost an experiential moment. It wasn't a raw intellect devoid of experience. I never quite saw it that way. That I would imagine Shia Leibovitz was like his arch intellect. He would have, as you read him, it was almost like, was there any emotion there? I didn't know him at all. My hunch is that, you know, when you get to the Einstein level and that level of intellect, I think for many, I can only speak about the Rub, whom I knew pretty well, is that it was an experiential moment. I appreciate that. I never have ever seen it that way. Galit, what did you want to say?
It's kind of about something before, but I just want to say I usually like to look at life through patterns. Like, it's kind of, it just helps me feel like I'm going through something. So let's say, like for an example, let's say I won Color War last year. So then I'm like, okay, then I make like a pattern from that, like whatever. So when to make a pattern, you need to have a history. So I feel like God's starting his pattern, kind of like his life anew. So like it's easier to have something coming, right. If you're coming from something.
Right. It's almost like the Rambam approach is that God is the God of philosophy. Rashi and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's approach is God is not the God of philosophy as much as he's the God of history. And I'll say something deeper, if I may. You see, for Rambam, what's the first mitzvah? For Maimonides. The arch intellect. For Maimonides, he says in the Taryag, in his Sefer Mitzvot, the first mitzvah is you have to believe in God. You got to believe in God.
First of the Ten Commandments.
It's the first of the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God. That's Rambam. Because Rambam says it's a philosophy. It's an intellect. What do you mean you don't believe? Sit down. You know, harva over the shear. Listen to a good talk. Or open up a couple of books. Take out a pen and paper. Hit your computer. You'll figure it out. It's a philosophy. There's no excuse not to believe. That's Rambam. That's why for Rambam, belief in God is a mitzvah. Are you ready? This may shock you, but there are many, many authorities who insist that belief in God is not a mitzvah. It is not one of the 613 commandments. Why not? Because belief is belief. It's an emotion. It's a feeling. And you can't command a feeling. You can't command a feeling. And that is why, for many, I am the Lord your God. It's not a mandate. It doesn't say, I mean, you know what Maimonides says with I am the Lord your God? He says the verb to be, it's an elliptical clause, and the verb to be should be read into it. Read it, even though it doesn't say it. I am to be the Lord your God. Rashi would say, well, what do you mean? That's not what it says. It's a statement, I'm the Lord your God. What do you mean, God's commanding you to believe? Feelings are feelings are feelings. That's quite poetic, right? In marriage encounter, we used to say, feelings are not right, they're not wrong, they just are. As a matter of fact, I go this far and say the following. I think in Christianity, in many, many forms of Christianity, belief is a must. If you don't believe,
then you don't.
There's no salvation.
Right.
You're damned. Judaism has a very, I think the mainstream of Judaism is going to have a very, very different approach.
I've got to say that faith is believing in something you know isn't true.
Okay.
No.
Let me just say this.
Yes, it is.
Let me try to formulate it this way. For Maimonides, the first thing you do is you talk about God. It begins with belief in God. Rashi says it doesn't begin with that. It's not that you believe in God and from belief everything flows. Belief in God could in fact be the net result of, let us say, analyzing Jewish history. It's not that necessarily the pedagogical movement is you believe in God and then you assess the history. There's an alternative. If you believe that, that's fine. But there's an alternative. The alternative is, even a Toynbee, who was an anti-Semite, he said, you know, when I look at Jewish history, Jews should be fossils. How do we exist? Well, he was touching upon the idea that the analysis of history, of Jewish history, our existence today, leads to the conclusion that we could not have been without some kind of higher power, without God. And that approach is really the approach that God is a God of history, God is the God of encounter, God is the God of experience. And I think that's what love is all about. If you have to intellectualize love, I think we're in trouble. But if we can experience the love, then how do you know you're in love? You just know you're in love. And sometimes you can't define it, you can't describe it, you can't talk about it. That is why there is a name of God. Now open your hearts for a moment. There is a name of God that is not read the way it is written, nor is it written the way it is read. Which name of God is that? Yud Ke Vav Ke. It's a phenomenon. We should not be saying it, but I'm saying it for educational purposes. When you look at Yud Hey Vav Hey and you sound it out, it's Jehovah. It's Jehovah. Well, if that's what it is when you sound it out, how come every time we see Yud Ke Vav Ke, we don't read it the way it is read, and rather, what is Yud Ke Vav Ke? It is Hashem, it's Adonai. Why is that? Why is it that it is read differently than it is written? It is written differently than the way it is. I'll tell you why. You can't read it the way it is written. Because if you read it the way it is written, what have you done? You've limited it. You've limited the name of God. It's the limitless name of God. It's the God of the experience. And precisely because it's limitless, that's why you don't sound it the way it's written. The fact that we say it differently than the way it is written, that I think speaks to this is a God that is beyond description. This is the God that has to be experienced. And I just want to tell you something, and I'm just taking this one last step, because we have to stop soon, but I want to say this. I think this latter idea, the idea that God is the God of the experience, of the encounter, of the history, I think that's one of the fundamental motifs of the ritual of the holidays. The ritual of the holidays. One of the most fundamental motifs. On Passover, we don't just remember that God took us out of Egypt. What do we do? What do we do?
We reenact it.
Like we're there. We're experiencing the Exodus. On Shavuot, we don't just remember that God gave Torah. We try to reenact it. On Sukkot, we live in the Sukkah. Why? I'll tell you why. Because there is a philosophy of mitzvot, of ritual, that says the following. You believe in God, and because you believe in God, you follow His mitzvot. What I'm suggesting this morning is that there's an opposite approach. The mitzvah may not be the result of my belief in God, but it may be the means through which I come to believe in God. Are you with me? The mitzvah may not be the result of my belief in God. That's my maimonidean. No, the mitzvah, which ultimately is what? What is the mitzvah? The mitzvah, at least the ritual of the holidays, is the encounter with God. It's the encounter. Shabbat is the love relationship with God. The mitzvah is not the result of belief in God. Rather, the mitzvah is the means through which I come to believe in God. It's pedagogically, it's very important. If you look at the pedagogy of the Christian community, their pedagogy begins and ends with what? Belief.
If you're not, then you can't.
You must believe. Believe. Monitor the sermons given by the pastors and the priests in their churches. I can tell you what the topic of their sermon is going to be. I listen to these men and women. I'm a student of speech. Their topic is always the same. You know what their topic is?
Love.
You better believe. Because if you're not, you love God. You better believe. Because if you don't believe, you're damned. When was the last time you walked into a shul, except for Oz, and heard rabbis talk about God? First of all, we should talk about God. But, I mean, pedagogically, what it's all about is that in Christianity, that's the point of emphasis. Now, please, don't walk out of here thinking, for us, God is very central. But I come back to that sentence. The mitzvah may not be the result of my belief in God. It may be rather the means through which I come to believe. Because the mitzvah is really a ritual expression of our historical encounter with God. And it's through that history that I come to believe. That's what it's about. And that can't be defined. So what do we have here? As we're about ready to talk about human names, we started by talking about, wait a minute, let's talk about God's names. And what we're saying is that when Moshe asks God, what is your name? A name is not just a name. A name is a definition of who we are, of who God is. Now, in God's case, we're arguing that there is a Maimonidean approach that gives us some kind of handle on God, but then there's another approach that says, God is limitless. God has no name. Although, as we shall see, God has many appellative titles, and the reason why God has so many names is there's no one way to define God. God has many, many different characteristics, many, many different sides, many, many different sides to God. Now it's all up to us to think about our own names. I'll tell you what you have to think about. Who was I named for? If I was named for anyone, do I know something about this person for whom I was named? And more profound, and not just I was named after my grandfather. I don't want to only know that he owned a grocery store on Sackman Street, and he gave and he sold pickles. Do I really know something about it? And then I think even more deeply, do I know the meaning of my name? And, you know, the mystics say that even though we're named when we're very, very young, ultimately we grow into our names, and our names become descriptive of who we are or who we should aspire to be, even as God's name, in its own way. I will be that which I will be, I'm arguing, is descriptive of what God is all about. Reflections, questions, quick? Last time.
I know this is the only time that God calls himself by this description. And if so, when was the next time in which name to use it? There must be an order to the name.
That's
because to go with the progression, to go from a name that is indescribable, you can't label it, to starting to label, to limit by giving other names, to me that means that that name was not, at that moment may have been right. Good, but it wasn't good at other moments.
It's a good point, and this is...
And that is that, therefore, I have to disagree with you on one thing. I don't think that God could live without people.
Exist, not live.
I don't think that God could live without people.
Yes,
it's like a writer that writes, or anybody that creates, and doesn't have anyone who read it or appreciate it.
But it's different, he has to write.
We're going to take this up. I once said that. I got into a lot of trouble, though. But you can, Gil, I hear what you're saying. And you're not in trouble at all. I love what you're saying.
One cannot live without. This is the mutuality that God has to relate to the people. And therefore, maybe that's why he had different names.
I always say the same as usual, the projection. To making God too human.
I see. Uniformable,
a jealous God.
I see.
Jealous is a human trait.
I see.
Jealous, God is not jealous.
Do you have a Jewish girlfriend here?
I got nothing.
What he's saying is so important is that what we are, we just project onto God, and that mirrors just what godliness is really what we are within ourselves.
We've got Rav Adam waiting, but okay.
Right?
Yeah, it's a great point. David's great. Galit, you're going to have the last word. Anybody else? Galit and Jesse, and then we really have to stop.
Stella? Just to bring in a story. Let's say a parent has a child. Let's say a parent has a child, and God forbid that child dies. Okay, and that child dies. That parent will still call themselves a parent forever. They're never going to stop calling themselves a parent, even though they have no children, even though they have no way to actually prove that they are a parent. A writer, even if he doesn't write any book, he's still a writer. You're still that person. Even, let's say a woman is a woman, she's born a woman, and then she has cancer and she loses everything that would technically make her a woman. She's not a man now, she's still a woman. So you're not defined by what you make or what you have. You're defined by like who you are and who you believe you are.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, but there's one thing that I want to add to that. For Judaism, the Yiddishkeit, the basic for me tenet is continuity of creation. Without continuity, we're not here. What you're talking about is a moment in time. I'm talking not about a mother who had the child and lost her child, because there's a breach of continuity. I'm talking about the concept of God in the framework of continuity. That's the difference.
I'm going to take Jesse's comment and then we're going to stop.
I go back to what you started with, leadership. I think this name which was given was the name given because Moses said, by what authority can I assume leadership? By what authority can I induce this change? I need a name that will make me a leader, entitled to get the homage, get the 20%, get that people to change. And that's why he has this name now, I guess. And that might be the name that you need in other situations, but when you want to say, in whose authority am I coming, I am speaking in the name of the king. I am leading you out on orders of... And that's where our leadership ultimately derives from. Our ability to change, even 20%, derives from somewhere.
Good. I do want... This, what we spoke about today, is of such import, and it really is a cornerstone in my rabbinate. Somebody comes to shul, the last thing that's on my mind is, does that person believe in God? You know, it's just not a... It's... You know, I would say to a person who doesn't believe, you know, that there are ways to come to believe. Even if you never come to believe, I embrace you. But I think that point, that the mitzvah is not the result, but the means, too, or history, you know, the sum total of Jewish history leads to that. Now, look, and I know that there are... And for me, Israel is part of that, too. But look, I know that there are wonderful Jews who, you know, are not of that belief. They look at the history of Israel and they don't see God in it, and I embrace them as well. But I think from my eyes, at least, from these small eyes, and I think the eyes of many, that the sum total of Jewish history leads to that conclusion. That's Ayashayet. And I want to give you an assignment. Take a look at chapter 2 in the book of Genesis, and you'll see there are a couple sentences in there that we skip over very quickly, but they're critical sentences. I have a rule, the ones we skip are the most important. And there are two sentences in there that talk about names. Literally talk about names. The word shame in chapter 2. There's a point in there where God says, I want to make a helpmate for Adam, and he parades all the animals in front of Adam, and Adam gives each of them a name. We've got to talk about that next week. We're way late. I'm sorry about that.
So does he make...
I'm sorry?
So how does he choose a name? Through like sounding, I guess?
Oh, we've got to talk about it. Like, got to miss chemistry next week.
I'm going to find some dish there. Thank you.